So causality. So causality is a powerful tool for imposing constraints on effective theory. So this has been known for a long time. It was resurrected about 10 years ago or so in this paper by Adams, Arkani Ahmed, Dubovsky, Nicholas, and Ratazzi, where they considered the example of a scalar field theory with a shift symmetry. And in a theory like this, if you have a coupling d phi to the fourth, that coupling has to come with a fixed sign. They were interested in this for brain world reasons, but just in general, if you have a low energy theory like this, the d phi to the fourth coupling has to come with a plus sign. If you find that d phi to the fourth has a minus, has a negative coupling, even a small one, then this theory can't be UV completed. So there's an infrared constraint that gives you an obstruction to UV completion. Now, this particular constraint also plays a key role in the proof of the A theorem. In that context, phi is the dilaton, and lambda is AUV minus AIR, and it's exactly this causality constraint that Komogodzki and Schwimmer used to argue that A has to decrease along RG flows. There are similar constraints in higher curvature gravity. So in that case, they're actually much stronger. So in higher curvature gravity, if you try to add, say, a Gauss-Bonnet term, then just last year, Kamenko, Edelstein, Maldacena, and Jaboyedov used a similar causality argument to say that actually Gauss-Bonnet coupling has to be zero. It's not just a sign constraint. You rule out both signs of the Gauss-Bonnet coupling. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's literally zero. It means that you can't add a Gauss-Bonnet term without also adding some new physics to deal with this problem at the scale of that term. So there are basically two arguments for this type of constraint, and they both rely on perturbative field theory. So the two arguments, one, as I alluded to, is causality. So you take this theory, you put it in some non-trivial background, and you ask if things propagate causally. The other one comes from looking at the scattering amplitudes. So there's an argument that uses dispersion relations, and the optical theorem does some contour magic and tells you that certain pieces of the scattering amplitude have to be positive. That gives you the same set of constraints. Now, both of these methods are sort of indirect. When we say causality in quantum field theory, the first thing we think of is commutators. But if you take a scalar field theory perturbatively and calculate the commutators, then any order perturbatively around the vacuum, the commutator is zero, a space-like separation. So when I say it's indirect, what I mean is that you can show that something's wrong with this theory, but it's been hard to sort of pin down exactly what's going on, because you can't seem to actually show that the commutators are non-vanishing. So the answer is that this has to happen somewhere in the UV of theories like this. But why is that happening? What exactly is going on in terms of the commutators was a bit mysterious. Now, this is related to the fact that the arguments are for these bounds are inherently Lorentzian. The optical theorem is a statement about scattering amplitudes. These are Lorentzian things. Causality, obviously, is a Lorentzian thing. And it's been sort of a mystery how to translate these into Euclidean constraints. Because, and it has to be possible, because we know that good Lorentzian theories are in one-to-one correspondence with good Euclidean theories. So this is basically a theorem. Or a set of theorems proved in the 60s and 70s that theories in Minkowski space, which are Lorentz invariant, unitary, and causal, are in one-to-one correspondence to theories in Euclidean space, which are rotationally invariant and reflection positive. So reflection positive is going to pop up again later, so let me define what that means. That's just the statement that in Euclidean signature, working on the plane, you can choose one of your coordinates to call Euclidean time arbitrarily, just pick one. And then correlation functions, which have insertions symmetrically under tau goes to minus tau, have to be positive real numbers. So this the correlation function in a mirror symmetric, a reflection symmetric configuration like this has to be positive. So that's basically the statement of unitarity translated to Euclidean signature, but also comes in when we want to talk about causality. Okay, so we have these constraints that come from Lorentzian arguments. We know that there has to be a problem, there has to be a way of phrasing this in Euclidean language. So a puzzle has been how to formulate these same constraints from Euclidean. So what I want to talk about today is a derivation of some analogous constraints in conformal field theory using the conformal bootstrap. Everything I'll say is for d greater than 2 dimensions. There's special things about 2-dimensional CFT that make it invalid. Unlike the perturbative arguments that I was just describing, this is something about strongly coupled field theory. Now, until the end of the talk, or possibly, depending on time, not at all in the talk, so I'm not going to assume large N. But if I were to take large N, then you can think of these constraints as the holographic dual of the d phi to the fourth constraint. In other words, if you put the scalar field of atoms at all in ADS, then there must be a statement that the dual CFT is inconsistent somehow, and that's the statement that I'll describe. But it's more general than that. It applies at small n and doesn't require holographic theory. For probes with spin, that is for the correlation functions of spinning fields, there's a connection between, I'll make the connection between these constraints and the Hoffman-Maldacena bounds and derive some of those bounds directly from the bootstrap. And also, I don't know if I'll get to this point, but I want to pinpoint the Euclidean problem with lambda d phi to the fourth theory. So we understand the Lorentzian problem. We know there must be a Euclidean problem. And using this method, we can tell you where it is. And in particular, why choosing the wrong sign, exactly why it leads to non-vanishing commutators at space-like separation. And I'm going to work entirely in position space. So this has some advantages and disadvantages. That's the idea. The CFT constraints are based on two papers with postdocs at Cornell, Sachin Jain and Sandipan Kundu. And the perturbative QFT results, if I get to them, I probably won't. But if I get to them, the perturbative QFT results are work in progress with some students at Cornell. Before I get into the CFT, I want to make one last point of motivation from the holographic point of view. So holographic CFTs have lots of universal behaviors. So what do I mean by universal? I mean, we think that there's probably lots of CFTs that are holographic. And anything you can calculate on the gravity side just by looking at the Einstein action is therefore a universal aspect of a huge swath of conformal field theories. So for example, the viscosity to entropy ratio is 1 over 4 pi. If you look at the three-point function TTT, this is parameterized by some numbers. Among them are the anomaly coefficients A and C. Every theory with a holographic dual, a local holographic dual, has A equal to C up to small corrections. So this is a complete mystery from the strongly coupled field theory point of view. From the dual point of view, we don't know why some big class of theories should have A and C related to each other. From the Bolt point of view, these are dictated by locality. In other words, by the statement that you can't just write any old action in ADS. You have to write an action where higher derivative terms are suppressed by the cutoff. So if you allowed higher derivative curvature couplings here, then you can change say 8 over s. But in the limit where you take, I'm talking about, in the string theory sense, I'm talking about a limit where you take the string scale large, and then locality tells you you expect these higher derivative terms to be suppressed. So in the bulk sense, that's what leads to this universality. And a very big question, I think, is how to derive these universal facts directly from CFT, or from strongly coupled field theory. Okay, so how do we do that? I don't know. But there are two things that I think are likely to be useful if we're to do that. One is the conformal bootstrap. So there have been some successes using the conformal bootstrap to derive universal properties of correlation functions in 2D CFT. And also, it's something you can get to work a little bit at long distances and higher dimensions. So that's one thing. The other thing is causality. So from the bulk point of view, the argument of Camano et al. that the Gasparet term has to be suppressed relied on causality. So it seems likely that causality is going to play some key role. And that was actually the initial motivation for studying this problem, was trying to work our way towards A equals C. Okay, so I'm not going to prove A equals C here. But it seemed like trying to understand how conformal bootstrap and causality fit together was a good first step, which I... Right, so that's as far as I'll say about deriving gravity, but that was kind of the, what's in the back of our minds here. Good, so I'm going to start by reviewing how causality is implemented in quantum field theory. So this is something that I think probably everyone has seen in momentum space, but a lot of people probably have not seen in position space, so I'm going to go through this in some detail. So causality is the statement that commutators vanish at space-like separation. This is a Lorentzian statement, but we really want to talk about the bootstrap, so that's how we're going to try to constrain these correlation functions. And the bootstrap is something that's usually formulated for Euclidean correlators. So what I want to do in the next 10 minutes is explain, in the sense of Euclidean field theory, what it means to declare that your commutators have to vanish at space-like separation. This is, in other words, I want to think of defining the theory in terms of the Euclidean correlators, and then ask the question, do these correlators in Lorentzian signature vanish? Do the commutators vanish at space-like separation? Okay, this is what I just said. So first, I want to answer the question, how is causality encoded in Euclidean correlation functions? And this is something that was understood a long time ago. You can read about it in Streeter and Whiteman if you have a free few months to do so. So I'll tell you the upshot. So Euclidean correlators are in many ways simpler than their Lorentzian counterparts. Euclidean correlation functions are permutation invariant. So there's no such thing as operator ordering in Euclidean signature. You can order the local operators. You can order them however you like. They have singularities only at coincident points. And there are no branch cuts. This is related to the statement that there's no operator order. So they're single valued on the Euclidean plane. What I'm saying here is any quantum field theory, not conformal field theory, but here's an example that we're familiar with. The conformal scalar. So the conformal scalar two-point function looks like this. You might be worried about branch cuts if delta's not an integer, but in Euclidean signature, the thing in here is always positive. So it's single valued. You can go around the singularities, you come back without picking up any phases or anything. But if we take this two-point function and we analytically continue to complex time, then there's an intricate structure of singularities and branch cuts. For example, let's look at that conformal scalar two-point function again. The function's the same, tau 2 squared plus y 2 squared to a non-integer power. But now tau 2 squared can be negative. And so there's a branch cut. If we look at this on the complex tau 2 plane, The branch cut starts at tau 2 squared is minus y 2 squared. So it's just starting exactly on the light cone. So when you take those two points, and you start moving one into Lorentzian signature, you're going to reach a branch cut exactly when those two points are light-like separated. What that means is that the analytic continuation to Lorentzian signature is ambiguous. When you encounter a branch cut, you have a choice. You could go to the right, like that, or you could go around to the left, like that. And these two choices correspond to the two ways that you can order your operators in Lorentzian signature. I've described this for two-point functions, but this is completely true in general. Every time you cross a light cone in a Lorentzian correlation function, you have to make a choice in how you go around a branch cut, and that choice is a choice of operator ordering. Now, how about the commutator? Well, it's clear from this discussion that the commutator of the two-point function is the discontinuity across a cut. If there were no branch cuts, then there would be no ambiguity and no commutators. So the discontinuity across the cut is the commutator. Now, in this case of the two-point function, there's no issue with causality. The fact that the Euclidean correlator we started with only had singularities at coincident points translates in Lorentzian signature into the statement that in the two-point function, this branch point that I've drawn is exactly at the Minkowski light cone. It's exactly where you expect it to be. So the two-point function is trivially going to satisfy causality. Things get interesting when we start to talk about four-point functions. So as I said, every time you cross a light cone, you encounter a branch point. So let's take this operator O2 and start moving it around in the in real time. So this is now a picture in real time with T going this way. So we're going to keep three of the operators fixed and start moving around O2, or O of X2. So when we move it past the first light cone, everything's fine. It's guaranteed by symmetry that that light cone was exactly where we expected it to be, and there's no non-trivial constraint from causality. OK, that's what I just said. SOD invariance guarantees that that first light cone was exactly where you expected it to be. But once you pass through the first branch cut, you don't know where you're going to hit the next branch cut. So if we had just come up this way, then we'd be fine. That first branch cut, we know where it is. This one, we know where it is. But if we go around this one and then head towards that one, you don't know where you're going to find that light cone. It might not be, it's not fixed by symmetry, in other words. Symmetries do not tell you where this light cone is. And the reason for that, I'll give this on the complex time plane in a second. But what that means is that causality inside a four-point function is the statement that this light cone singularity, as you approach this guy, better not appear too soon. If there were a singularity and a branch cut here, that would violate causality. The theory would be inconsistent. So in terms of the analytically continued correlation function, causality is a statement that that correlator is analytic in some region of complexified space-time. There's some region around here where you don't want to find any singularities in your correlation function. Here's the same picture in the complex time plane. So this is that first light cone that we hit. This is that second light cone that we hit. With one choice of operator ordering, you're OK. We know where these points are. They're right on the Minkowski light cones. And if we choose our operator's order this way, then it's guaranteed to be causal. So there's no issue. Where the issue comes in is when you start choosing other operator orderings that send you through these branch cuts. Just because the red dot was at this point when I originally drew it, doesn't mean it's at the same point after you go through the other branch cuts. So this is the issue of causality. It's that when you start looping around some of the branch cuts in your analytically continued correlation function, the other branch cuts might jump around. Okay? If you loop around here and this branch cut jumps up, then actually we don't think that's possible, but you might be okay. At least it's not causality violating. If it jumped down, then you're definitely in trouble. If it jumped down, then you have a commutator that's non-vanishing at space-like separation. So the commutator O comma O becomes non-zero when we hit that red dot. Everything I've said is usually stated in terms of an I epsilon prescription. Like if you read about it in Streeter and Whiteman, there's an I epsilon prescription that deals with, that effectively deals with these pictures without ever talking about paths. In the end, it's completely equivalent to what I've just described. Okay. So all of this was for a general quantum field theory. In CFT, the same thing is true. The difference is that things are a little simpler, because in CFT, we can write the four-point function in terms of two cross ratios. So these two cross ratios are z and z bar. So now, instead of having to talk about analytic continuation to however many large number of horrendous number of variables, we could just talk about analytic continuation in z and z bar when we go to Lorentzian signature. So analytic functions of one variable, or complex analysis in one variable, we're pretty used to. Complex analysis in two variables gets pretty tricky. If we really had to deal with all these variables, it would be pretty awful, but two is not too bad. So causality in conformal field theory is a statement about where the four-point function g of zz bar is analytic in some multi-cheated cover of two copies of the complex plane. Let that sink in for a second. So causality is the causality question of where this is analytic. Z and Z bar are independent complex numbers, but keeping track of their value is not enough. You also have to keep track of what sheet you're on. So it's a multi-valued function. You have to keep track of how you got to the particular point. There'd be a more concrete example of this in a few slides, but that's the idea. Okay. Now, the key thing about Euclidean quantum field theory that prevents this from happening. Remember, we said at the beginning that it's known that good Lorentzian theories are in one-to-one correspondence with good Euclidean theories, right? So I've just argued that you should worry about whether these singularities jump around after going through a branch cut. The thing that prevents that from happening is reflection positivity. So this was understood by Osterwalder and Schrader a long time ago. So if you have a Euclidean theory that's reflection positive, and you go through these analytic continuations, that ensures that the singularities don't jump in the wrong direction when you go through cuts. What I'm going to do in this talk is to first rediscover this fact that reflection positivity implies causality, but I'm going to rediscover it in a way that's in bootstrap language. Okay, so I'm going to rediscover this in bootstrap language and then show that not only does it imply causality, it also implies constraints on the low dimension operators in the spectrum. The basic idea is to use crossing symmetry. So crossing symmetry relates a function of the cross ratios z and z bar to that same function at 1 minus z at 1 minus z bar. If you take limits where two operators come together, that sends z and z bar to 0 or 1. So that would, so sending these to, say, to 0 would be a UV limit. Sorry, sending these to zero would be an IR limit, because you're dominated by the low dimension stuff in the spectrum. But then if you take that same function and you calculate it in the other channel, it's a UV limit. So crossing symmetry relates UV to IR. The dominant terms in one channel, if the dominant terms in one channel are the low dimension things in the spectrum, then the dominant terms in the other channel have to be the high dimension stuff. So this is a UV-IR relation. And the idea is to take reflection positivity in one of these channels, call it the S channel, say, show that reflection positivity implies causality, and then to compare to the other channel. When we compare to the other channel, we're going to find constraints on the couplings in the T channel. That's the strategy. So this is building on the light cone bootstrap. This is a program sometimes called the analytic conformal bootstrap that's been going on for a few years, which is bootstrap in Lorentzian signature, but was for space-like separated operators in Lorentzian signature. And what we need to do is extend that to time-like separated operators. So that's the first, that's the thing that we basically have to overcome here. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at the bootstrap in a particular state. And that state I'm going to call the shockwave state. This is a particular state in the conformal field theory, and we're just going to require commutators to obey causality in this state and phrase that in the language of the bootstrap. The definition of the shockwave state is you take an operator, a local primary operator psi, and you insert it at imaginary time. This state, acting on the vacuum, is a state in the Lorentzian theory. So don't be bothered by the I delta. Yes, there's an imaginary time here, but we're just thinking of this as an initial condition. So inserting it in imaginary time just gives you an initial condition. And now we're going to talk about this state in Lorentzian signature. So for small delta, this insertion creates a stress tensor with support on an expanding null shell. This isn't obvious from looking at it, but you can calculate the expectation value of the stress tensor as a three-point function. Three-point functions are completely fixed between two scalars and the stress tensor. And you can check that the stress energy here is basically shooting out. I've drawn it in two dimensions, but there's an expanding null shell here. So that's why it's called a shockwave state. This is a state that's been, there's other work on shockwave states, especially in ADS-CFT. This is a little different from what's been called shockwaves in some contexts. It's the same as what's been called a shockwave in the context of entanglement. So the paper was by Takinagi, and also work that Fede and Alice and Curtis and I did on entanglement entropy. This is the same state that was considered in that context. Okay, so that's the state. Now we're going to ask whether probe correlation functions are causal in this state. So psi creates some background, and now we're going to calculate the OO two-point function in this background. And what we're going to do is we're going to take this probe operator, move it close to the light cone of the other probe operator, and require that singularity doesn't appear too soon. Causality is the statement that this commutator of probe operators better be zero at space-like separation. Since the state itself is created by a psi insertion, this is a question about a four-point function. Okay, so one of these. So the first guy in the four-point function creates the state. Then you have the probes, O and O. And then you have the bra on the other side, which is why I've written two psi's sitting at the origin here. So causality, as I've just described, is the statement that this four-point function must be an analytic function in some region before the light cone. We can't hit any singularities before the light cone. So you can work all that out in terms of the t's and x's, which I won't subject you to, and then you can translate it into a statement about the conformal cross ratios, z and z bar. And what you end up with at the end of the day is the following statement. If you take your four-point function, which has singularities at 0 and 1, and you send z around 0, this is that singular, this is as you send z around 0 and head back towards 1, then this is the region just before the light cone where you better not have a singularity. So causality is the statement that the light cone singularity does not appear in this purple blob after going around the cut. It can appear exactly at the red, it could appear exactly at the red dot. That would be the ordinary Minkowski light cone. It might, in principle, move down. Actually, that doesn't happen in this case, but I don't know if it's a general theorem. That would be a time delay. But it better not move up. That would be a time advance. OK, so far, what I've described is I've translated causality into a statement about the correlation function. It's a statement that the correlation function better be analytic in this region. The next step is to analyze this correlator using conformal bootstrap methods. So what is this purple region? Well, it's some region of complexified space-time before you hit the light cone here. It's easier to draw accurately in z and z bar, but impressionistically, it's some complexified region of space-time on that picture. So the first result, which I'll give you one equation for, is that in a reflection-positive CFT, the correlator is indeed analytic in this domain. And I'll just give you one equation for how you derive something like this. So you take the conformal block expansion, which is a sum of some numbers, A, H, H bar, times powers of Z and Z bar. Now, reflection positivity tells you that actually these coefficients are positive. If you take the statement of reflection positivity, which, remember, was this fact about certain correlators coming with a plus sign, you can smear the four-point function and conclude that every one of these coefficients is a positive number. Now, when you go to calculate the correlator in Lorentzian signature, remember we had to go around a cut to do that. We had to go around a cut. And what ends up happening when you go around the cut is that you take this z, and you replace z by e to the 2 pi I z. So that just sticks some phases. So you started with a Euclidean correlator, and you wanted to calculate the Lorentzian correlator. To get from the Euclidean correlator to the Lorentzian correlator, you just stick in some phases. Now, if you were in a totally general sum here without knowing anything about the coefficients, then you don't know what happens when you stick in phases. But if you have positive coefficients and you stick in phases, the correlator can only decrease in magnitude. Therefore, it's analytic. So to recap, you calculate the Lorentzian correlator. You invoke reflection positivity. And you find that you still have a convergent sum. Well, if you can define your function by a convergent sum, then it's an analytic function. That's pretty much the definition of analytic. So good. So it's analytic. This was, in fact, the result of the Osterwalder-Schrader theorem long ago. We already knew this was going to work. But now it's been phrased in a very hands-on kind of way. Osterwalder and Schrader went to momentum space. did all sorts of fancy stuff, and they concluded that this was true. Now we see what's going on in terms of the conformal block expansion. You're just sticking some phases into a positive sum. So it still has no singularities. Okay, questions so far? So far we just rediscovered this fact that was known like 100 years ago. Well, 40 years ago.
So in order to apply that argument, do you need to go to the region where Z and Z bar are real?
Yeah, so they turn out to be real in this configuration. Yeah. Well, there's some subtlety there. You have to do some change of variables that Matthias can tell you about. and so you go to this row coordinate, it's called, and then you can show that it's real. But effectively it's real. OK, so we've derived that the correlator is analytic on this region. And now we want to get to the infrared constraints. Now we want to show that the analyticity actually gives you constraints on the low dimension operators in the spectrum. What we're going to do is we're going to take our analytic function and integrate it on a closed contour. So I told you about this region where it was analytic. We're just going to integrate it around a closed contour on the edge of that region. You can translate this into a region of the Z and Z bar plane. If we have an analytic function, we are immediately tempted to integrate it on a closed contour and set it equal to 0. Okay, so that's what we do. And what we're going to get out of that is a dispersion relation. Well, it's something like a dispersion relation. This is how you derive dispersion relations. But it's for the position space correlator. So this is not your usual dispersion relation in quantum field theory. In terms of how you can apply it and so on, it seems to be pretty similar, but it's a different kind of dispersion relation. What happens is that part of this contour, so then you have to do some conformal block magic, which I'm not going to go through the calculation of the conformal blocks. But what happens is that part of this contour is an infrared calculation. On part of this contour, the correlator can be calculated exactly, well, to leading order. It can be calculated, and it's fixed by the infrared data. That's this part of the contour. On another part of the contour, the correlator is fixed by the UV data, which we don't know. We're not going to assume anything about the, we're not going to assume that we solved this theory. We don't know anything about the UV, except that it's reflection positive. Okay, so what this integration is going to do, it's going to tell you that some known function that you get by integrating here is positive. So it's going to tell you that some infrared quantity has a sign constraint. So when the dust settles, you get a sum rule that looks like the following. You have some infrared coupling, lambda IR, that you get equal to something in the UV, some integral over the UV correlator that's manifestly positive. Therefore, in any theory, this infrared coupling has to come with a plus sign. Since we're in a light cone limit, it turns out that the dominant infrared exchange here is going to be the exchange of the operator with minimal twist. So twist is dimension minus spin. If you were doing a expansion in a Euclidean singularity, that ends up being organized in terms of scaling dimension. But when you do an expansion near a light cone, the conformal block expansion is organized in terms of twist. So the leading term is going to be the operator of minimal twist. Often this is the stress tensor, and that's mostly what I'll assume for the next few slides. If this is the stress tensor, then the IR coupling that I'm referring to is the coupling of the probe to the minus minus component of the stress tensor. Yeah.
Sorry, so what are you using as input precisely? Only this series, or are you also using the conformal blocks?
So in one channel, which is the UV channel, we only use this fact. In the other channel, the IR channel, we actually plug in the known conformal block for stress tensor exchange. And then when you do the integral, you pick and choose in different parts of the contour. Like on one part of the contour, you use this expression, where all you know is some positivity property. On the other part of the contour, you use the known conformal block for stress tensor exchange. So you get a relation between the two. And that's why you end up getting that this combination has to be positive.
And are you assuming anything about higher spin states in the spectrum?
So I've assumed only that there's a finite, so far I've assumed that there's a finite number of minimal twist operators. If you're saying a free theory or something, then things get tricky. Other questions? Okay, so now I'm going to discuss some applications. I'll just go through as many as we can get through in the last 15 or 20 minutes. So that's the method. There's this sum rule that tells you that certain things in the IR have to be positive. First application is trivial. Suppose we have scalar operators, and that the minimal twist exchange is a stress tensor. Well, then actually this coupling that we just fixed to be positive is fixed by the Ward identity to be equal to the scaling dimension, essentially, of that scalar probe. So that scaling dimension is obviously positive. Therefore, this coupling is obviously positive. If you go through the causality constraint, you just get back this obvious constraint. So we didn't really gain anything if you take scalar operators and do stress tensor exchange. But it worked, gives the right sign. So it was 50-50, and it came out right. That's the easiest calculation to do, but the result is sort of trivial. Now, the other applications that I'll tell you about are very similar. They're different situations. They get technically more difficult. There are various ingredients in this sum rule that I don't want to go into, but it's in terms of the steps, it's exactly identical. So you get all these other applications from similar logic. So then the second application is to the Maldacena-Gerbeyatov theorem. So the Maldacena-Gerbeyatov theorem says that a theory cannot have any finite number of higher spin conserved currents. Actually, it says two things. It says what I just said, that you can't have a finite number of higher spin conserved currents, and that the theory has free correlation functions if you have any higher spin conserved currents. This causality argument that I've just described immediately gives you the first half of this theorem. So if you look at the exchange of a field with spin greater than 2, then you can effectively derive two different sign constraints by looking at the correlator in different directions on the complex plane. One of the sign constraints tells you that the higher spin field has to come with a plus sign. The other one tells you it has to come with a minus sign. Under the assumption that there's some finite number of these things being exchanged, you rule out higher spin currents entirely. So if you have one, you need to have an infinite number of them to make this argument break down. Okay, third application, probes with spin. So this is a lot like the scalar case, but now we're going to take this operator that we're sending through the shockwave and give it a bunch of indices. Okay, so now this is some spinning operator. And in the scalar case, the three-point function that coupled the spinning, that coupled the scalar to the stress tensor was fixed by the Ward identity. But in the spinning case, that's not true. So in the spinning case, there are lots of couplings. There are lots of numbers, coupling constants, that tell you the coefficient of various tensor structures in this three-point function. And only one of them is fixed by the Ward identity. There's a bunch of other ones. And so you can apply this same logic. And what you end up with is something that sort of looks like a null energy constraint. You end up with the statement that spinning operators, this is contraction with a polarization tensor, that spinning operators like this couple to null energy with a particular sign in the limit where you take the probes, the probe spinning operators to be light-like separated. So this is a general constraint that applies to any conformal field theory, assuming that the minimal twist exchange is the stress tensor. In general, this is a new constraint, but there's one particular case. By in general, I mean if we put some random, say we stick some non-conserved spin six operator here, okay, that has a huge, terrible number of coupling constants, but it's pretty easy to plug the general form into this equation, and you get a whole bunch of inequalities for those coupling constants. There's some cases that are particularly interesting. So, So this is what I just said. The full three-point function is fixed by conformal invariance up to some numbers. So this is a set of inequalities for those numerical couplings. And a particularly interesting example is when the probe is the stress tensor itself. So when the probe is the stress tensor itself, what you're constraining are the stress tensor three-point functions, TTT. Okay, so if you take TTT and you plug the most general possible stress tensor three-point function into this equation here, which I warn you is missing some factors. You have to look in the paper if you want the right equation. So you take the most general stress tensor three-point function, plug that in, and you can find constraints on the couplings. The constraints that we find can be stated in terms of the anomaly coefficients A and C. And this is the crazy looking inequality that you get out of this constraint. Why 13 over 54? I couldn't tell you. So this can be compared to other constraints on stress tensor couplings. So Hoffman and Maldacena showed a few years ago that that if you calculate the energy deposited in a calorimeter in a particular state of a conformal field theory, and you require that integrated energy over all time, the total energy deposited over all time to be positive, that you get some similar looking inequalities on the stress tensor three-point functions. And they get a slightly stronger bound on A over C. Now, although I think everybody, including me, believes that this bound is accurate and applicable in general, is not actually proved from quantum field theory. So we don't really know. There could be loopholes in this. Actually, there was a paper a week or two ago that possibly proved this in a new way. I think there's still some assumptions. There was a paper on deep inelastic scattering conformal field theory, if you saw it. So maybe this is proved now. Anyway, when we were writing this, it wasn't proved. So the Hoffman-Maldacena one was not. And moreover, there wasn't any clear connection to causality in the Hoffman-Maldacena bounds. Now, if you're paying attention to the holographic dual of the Hoffman-Maldacena bounds, which was done earlier by Rob and people, that argument was causality. But on the CFT side, there was never a connection between Hoffman-Maldacena and causality. So this makes that connection. Now, this paper I mentioned at the beginning of the talk about the vanishing Gauss-Bonnet coupling can be rephrased as a statement that in holographic theories, A equals C up to small corrections. This is this you can think of as a stronger version or an improved version of the Hoffman-Maldacena bounds. And that was sort of the initial motivation for doing this bootstrap. I think to derive A equals C from conformal field theory is clearly hard. It's related to emergence of locality in the bulk. But I think it's plausibly within reach of existing techniques at this point with enough effort. So, anomalous dimensions, I didn't really describe the connection to anomalous dimensions, but these correlation functions can be computed by the light cone bootstrap in holographic theories. And then the causality constraints tell you that certain things that show up in that calculation have a certain sign. It's plausible, at least, there could be obstacles. It's plausible, at least, that on the 1 or 2 year kind of timescale, not the very long timescale, that this can be derived directly from CFT, I think. Okay, the next application is a surprise for scalar fields in CFT. And actually, I shouldn't even be mentioning this one in a talk because it's work in progress. There's potential pitfalls here. The convergence of the sum rule is a little trickier in this situation. But the reason I'm going to mention it is because I want you to tell me if you know of a counterexample to the following theorem or following claim. So scalar operators in CFT obey the unitarity bound. The dimension of a scalar operator is bounded by d minus 2 over 2. Saturated by free scalars. The claim is that scalars which are neutral, that is, or more generally, scalars which appear in a reflection positive OPE, O dagger O, have a higher unitarity bound. That these operators can only go down to d minus 2. So it differs by a factor of 2 from the ordinary unitarity bound. In other words, the anomalous dimension of the operator phi dagger phi always has to be positive. Okay, so there's some caveats in the derivation that didn't apply to the previous results I was saying, but it's similar logic. And we haven't been able to find a counterexample of this. If you know of one, you could embarrass me now, or we could talk afterward. I'd be very curious to hear about it. This has a strange corollary that light scalars in anti-de-Sitter space can't have cubic couplings. If you translate this statement about the dimension of this operator to ADS field theory, it suggests that scalars with a low enough dimension can't have self 3-point functions. In other words, cubic couplings in the bowl. I don't know of a counterexample, say, in a stringy construction, and I don't know of a CFT that violates this, but this is work in progress.
Should be the same scalar, or it can be different scalars?
In this one?
Yeah, so if I have like some playable index on the scalars, and by light, say, relevant or marginal operator, is that light?
This applies to any operators as long as phi and phi are the same operator.
Okay, so, but my question was, what do you mean by light scalar?
Oh, you're talking about the ADS statement?
Yeah, I'm just talking because, you know, if there is a counter, and then it must be the same scalar. It cannot be like a Clayley index.
The simplest statement is for a single scalar, but really the statement is that scalars of dimension less than d minus 2 are not allowed to appear in exchange diagrams.
But 2 and higher can appear as cubic couplings. I'm not appearing as cubic couplings.
2 and higher what?
Scalars of dimension 2 and higher cannot appear.
Are you in d equals 4?
Yeah. Well, yes, in d equals 4 or ADS 5.
Uh huh.
Cannot appear as a cubic coupling in a string down. Well, we can talk later.
Oh, okay. Maybe that sounds like a related statement. Let's talk after. Okay, I'll tell you about one last application. This is the one I mentioned at the beginning. If we take large N in all this, then what we're talking about here is the holographic dual of the d phi to the fourth constraint where the story started. So if you take a scalar field theory in ADS and you turn on a contact interaction d phi to the fourth, then that's going to so we're considering this scalar theory now as a theory in the bulk. This is the gravity side of ADS CFT, but gravity is completely decoupled. That's consistent as long as we think of this as an effective theory both on both sides. So as long as we only talk about low-dimension operators, that's a consistent thing to do. So we think of this scalar theory, and we translate the existence of this d phi to the fourth coupling into a statement about the CFT. So what's going on in the dual CFT? In the dual CFT, a free scalar in the bulk is dual to some scalar operator O. But you don't just have O, you also have lots of double, you also have lots of multi-trace stuff like O squared, DDO, and so on. So this, without, if before you turn on the quartic coupling, this is your dual. It's this list of generalized free scalar operators. Now, if you turn on that quartic coupling in the bulk, you're going to have some small deformation of what's of the CFT here, and that was worked out by Heemskerk and collaborators. And what they found is that when you turn on a coupling like that, you turn on an anomalous dimension for the spin 2 operator. So the anomalous dimension of this spin 2 operator in the CFT translates into the d phi to the fourth coupling in the bulk. Now, if you take the sum rule that I described, it's basically the same as the statement that stress tensors have to come with a plus sign, because this spin 2 operator contributes to the sum rule in much the same way that a stress tensor would. It has to contribute with a plus sign. Well, you end up getting minus gamma in the sum rule. So this tells you that bulk coupling has to be positive, that the anomalous dimension of the CFT has to be negative. So that's another case where we get back a non-trivial bound. Let me just say the last application in words. So far everything I've talked about was, all the applications I talked about were conformal field theory, but this basic idea about taking the position space correlator and deriving dispersion relations for it is not special to conformal field theory. You can do this in perturbative quantum field theory. In particular, you could do it if you wanted in regular old d phi squared plus d phi to the fourth theory. This is completely different. It's the same Lagrangian, but it's a completely different calculation from what I just described. So what I described was the holographic dual, but you could just apply it directly to d phi to the fourth in flat space. Or whatever other Lagrangian you're interested in constraining, and that also works. And you get back some known constraints. So far, we haven't found any new ones that way, but it is probing sort of a different region of parameter space compared to the previous methods. So could possibly be useful in perturbative field theories too. So to summarize, in a causal slash unitary, so the two are equivalent. If the theory is unitary or causal, position space correlation functions have some analogs of things that we usually like to do in momentum space. There's positivity conditions, which you can kind of think of as the position space version of the optical theorem. In momentum space, we have positivity conditions, which are the optical theorem. Here we have positivity conditions that came from reflection positivity. They're related, but are reorganized. And you have dispersion relations relating UV pieces of the correlators to IR pieces of the correlators. And that these dispersion relations impose constraints on the IR couplings of both conformal and ordinary perturbative quantum field theories. All right, thanks a lot.
Is it true that every non-unitary four-point function violates causality?
Oh, dear. I don't think so, no. So the one-to-one correspondence requires you to have all three things on both sides. So there's no one-to-one mapping between unitarity and reflection positivity or unitarity and causality. It's if you have all of them on one side, then you have all of them on the other. But I think,
because, for example, Li Yang in two dimensions, those correlation functions, they don't violate causality.
Oh, they don't? I don't know. Is that right?
And I also had another question. So about these shockwave states, could you get some mileage, extra mileage, by considering more general states?
Very possibly. I mean, certainly higher point functions contain other information. I mean, all of this I should have mentioned are necessary but not sufficient conditions. Especially in the spinning case, where we got a weaker condition from Hoffman-Maldacena, we very strongly suspect that if we were a little bit more clever, we would have gotten the full Hoffman-Maldacena conditions. But we just couldn't manage to pull it out of these position space inflection positivity constraints. Reorganizing the calculation a little bit easily could give stronger bounds. We don't know.
Any other questions?
If you consider 2D, which of the arguments goes wrong?
In two dimensions, there are always an infinite number of minimal twist operators.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's possible, actually, at large central charge, I think it's very likely that you could make similar statements, because that basically decouples some of those higher contributions. But in general, this infinite number of minimal twist operators is the problem.
I can ask one more. So when you derive dispersion relation, are you just integrating over the correlator, or you're multiplying some functions? Is there any kind of freedom that you can multiply something?
Yeah, there is. We haven't really played with that in much detail. It seems likely that for the spinning correlators, you might actually get stronger constraints by doing that. The calculation is just a little harder. So.
Well, let's thank Tom again.